Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of President Trump's address to the nation on his strategy for America's longest war in Afghanistan, now in its 16th year. Two specialists who have spent a lot of time in the country join us, starting with Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer and a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program and author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. We'll discuss the complex and contradictory strategic landscape surrounding landlocked Afghanistan, with Pakistan in the east and south sabotaging the U.S. at every turn, and Russia in the north now arming the Taliban. And while Iran to the west is the best bet to work with India to get our irons out of the fire, Trump is likely to resume sanctions and provoke hostilities at the behest of both our Israeli and Saudi allies who want us to go to war against Iran. Meanwhile, Iran and India have built a port, road, and rail link from the Indian Ocean into Herat, Afghanistan, which could be the only way for India, as Trump announced, to help with the reconstruction of Afghanistan. Then we look further into Trump's just-announced Afghanistan strategy that was long on bravado and promises but short on specifics, and speak with Robert Young Pelton, the author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. He joins us to discuss how the generals, Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly, won the argument with the ignoramus, their commander-in-chief, over Bannon, who wanted to privatize the war in Afghanistan and hand it over to the hedge fund billionaire Feinberg, who owns DynCorp, and the Blackwater founder Eric Prince, the brother of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who is close to Vice President Pence and has been on the Chinese payroll while in bed with the Emiratis, where he has a private army. Then finally, we'll get an assessment of the let them eat cake moment that has social media abuzz following an Instagram that Louise Linton, the trophy wife of the Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, sent out cataloging the designer outfit and accessories she was wearing on a visit to Fort Knox, where the nation's gold is stashed. Robin Givhan, the Washington Post fashion critic, joins us to discuss her article at the Washington Post, Louise Linton just spelled out her value system to you common folk. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program who specializes in South Asia security issues. She's a member of Women in International Security and the American Institute for Pakistan Studies, and her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me again.
And what did you make of Donald Trump's speech last night about Afghanistan, which was clearly long on promises and short on details?
Well, I think the first thing to notice is that there, with the exception of one thing, there was nothing new. President Obama, actually during his entire two administrations, repeatedly signaled out Pakistan for its continued support of the Taliban, the Haqqani Network, and other foreign terrorist groups. So there was nothing new there. And similarly, just as Obama failed to do, President Trump failed to identify what we're going to do, not if, but rather when, Pakistan demonstrates its intransigence in terms of refusing to deny sanctuary, refusing to provide active support to the numerous militant groups that the United States has identified and prescribed. So there was nothing new there. He didn't identify a strategy, just like the presidents before him. He didn't identify what does it mean to win. It may not be entirely apparent to everyone in this country that we've actually lost this war, pretty much on the installment plan. And so what does it actually mean to win? I mean, he needs to define that and flesh that out. Is it simply a withdrawal with some sort of face saving, as we tried to do in Vietnam, or is it actually some sort of positive statement of victory? He didn't identify that. I don't actually expect him to identify that, for that matter. What is new is that he identified India as a partner upon whom the United States will be increasingly dependent. And what is interesting about this is that the Indians for many years had been really adamant, that they wanted a larger role of this type in Afghanistan. But the Americans had already told them no, fearing that Pakistan would be upset. So this is actually something quite new, and I think this is coming out of General Nicholson. General Nicholson is the commander of NATO and U.S. forces in Afghanistan. He has been following this issue very closely. I first met him in Afghanistan when he was commanding troops in Kunar back in 2008. So he knows the problem set about which he speaks. The question for me is whether or not the Indians are actually going to follow through, or was this simply a bluff that the Americans have called? So for me, that's the biggest risk. He also declined to discuss Iran. Iran's an important player, as is China, as is Russia. Russia, taking its cue from the hyped-up ISIS threat in Afghanistan, is actually using that as an excuse to actively fund the Taliban. So there wasn't a lot new. That which is new is going to be we'll have to follow very closely to see what the Indians do. And he omitted key players in the region, which was a little bit disappointing.
But when you mentioned that President Obama had singled out the Pakistanis, it's one thing to verbally accuse them of doing what they've been doing in this perfidious, backstabbing way that they have been doing since day one, but it's another thing to do something about it. So was there anything in Trump's speech that indicated he'd actually do something about it?
Well, no. I mean, there was one interesting line where he said he was basically taking the constraints off the generals. If you wanted to read into that, you could suggest that perhaps this is allowing the military in Afghanistan to engage in hot pursuit across the Pakistan border, something that we haven't really done since 2002, and we did that very selectively. But the short answer is no. And similarly, this was Obama's problem. So there is an upside here. You know, let's just step back and take a look at the upside. There are several people, and until recently, including Bannon, that had very different ideas about Afghanistan. You'll remember that Bannon was a proponent of what Eric Prince had proposed, which is to basically outsource this entire war to mercenaries, which is, of course, illegal. It's also insane and unacceptable to our partners. So in some very significant way, we dodged a very big bullet. Given that Bannon was only recently ousted, I myself was very suspicious about what we would see. So the fact that we even saw something that reflected any dimension of policy continuity is actually a good thing. He talked about this is going to be driven by outcomes and not timelines, but he didn't specify what the timelines were. And he talked about we're not going to be engaging in nation building anymore, but this just reflects his ignorance about what we've actually been doing. We're not trying to make Afghanistan look like a democracy in our reflection. By the way, our democracy right now is pretty much under strain with our institutions imperiled. But what we've really been doing in the last several years under Obama, we've been really focusing on building up the Afghan National Security Forces and the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Interior that supports those institutions. That's incredibly important. And so it's not clear to me, based upon his speech, that he really understands what we've been doing and what we need to do, and that is to make sure that the ANSF, the Afghan National Security Forces, are going to be able to sustain what is going to be a very long-term onslaught from Pakistan. He also didn't mention financial commitments. This is important. We can scale troops up or down, but the lesson that we draw from President Najibullah in 1992 is that he hung on for a couple of years after the last Soviet troop crossed the Amu Darya. He fell in 1992 as soon as the Soviets were broke, the Soviet Union had crumbled, and its successor state could no longer pay the bill. So ensuring financial continuity and trying to get Afghanistan to be economically stable is just as important as any troop commitment, and I heard nothing about that last night.
And again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies program who specializes in South Asian security issues. She is a member of Women in International Security and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies, and her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. So you mentioned Bannon being out, but now he's on the outside throwing rocks from Breitbart. They have a piece headline today, "Here's McMaster's Voice, Is Trump's Afghanistan Policy Difference from Obama?" which is, of course, a deep insult to Trump's base. And the headline article In Breitbart today, the lead story is Eric Prince, Trump will roll over and accept same failed strategy on Afghanistan. So he's already had Eric Prince on, who was a regular in any case earlier in when Bannon was back there.
It's also useful to note that Eric Prince's older sister is Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education. So this a little bit of conflict of interest that Eric Prince was vying to be the outsourcee of this war in Afghanistan.
Along with Feinberg, the hedge fund billionaire who owns DynCorp. But I don't think you can count Bannon out because he's still got Mercer's money. And Eric Prince, by the way, is very close to Vice President Pence, along with having his sister in the cabinet. But what's not known about Prince or often discussed is that he's a lackey of the Chinese. They pay his bills, as do the as do the Emiratis, where his private army is based. So,
he's deeply compromised. I mean, as you said, he is very much funded by the Gulf State Arab monarchs as well as China. He is doing his own bidding, make no mistake, and he was also likely behind the hearing by Dana Rohrabacher some years ago advocating for the separation of Balochistan. He was also, he served on Rohrabacher's staff some time ago, and so they are also very close. So this is one of those things where conspiracy theorists can simply have some fun, because many of the conspiracies about him are actually likely to be true. Mm-hmm. But going back to Bannon, I do know someone that works on McMaster's staff, and he or she has talked about at length the war between McMaster and Bannon. I think that with Bannon's ouster, at least with respect to the policy, we're going to see greater adherence to McMaster's vision. And he also has the support of several other generals that are in the administration, right? So we've got General Kelly retired, and we also have General Mattis retired. And those three seem to be much more on the same page. And so I suspect that what Bannon is going to try to do is going to try to sabotage him from outside. But I don't think that that's actually going to change the things that are actually happening in the White House itself. And you also have, of course, General John Nicholson, who is one of the most capable and competent generals we've had in Afghanistan. And I heard in the discussion, for example, about India, his imprimatur. So Bannon is going to continue launching grenades at the Trump administration, which I think is actually quite lovely. I don't think that's going to have the immediate effect of changing this policy. The fact that Trump had to swallow his words about the immediate pullout suggests that he's already kind of committed to this. Now, and so far, it's been not quite 24 hours, but it's been a number of hours, and we haven't seen any reverse tweeting like he did in Charlottesville.
Well, just to add to what we were talking about, Eric Prince being compromised. Dana Rohrabacher is pretty compromised. His own colleagues, including the number two Republican in the House, said, I swear to God, Dana Rohrabacher and Donald Trump are on Putin's payroll. So let's talk about whether or not Trump...
Well, so I'm glad that you raised that, because something that he did not discuss last night, which I can understand why he wouldn't, but it's very important, is that the Russians are now actively funding the Taliban. The Russians are using the excuse of ISIS to fund the Taliban. And so this is an important development. We also have Iran not certain what the U.S. policy is going to be about the U.S.-Iran deal. And the Taliban, in its effort to try to find some sort of funder beyond Pakistan, they've also turned to Iran. And then China, not India, is the biggest investor in terms of private sector investment in Afghanistan, and he didn't mention that at all either. So the three big players that he didn't mention, China, Russia, and Iran, are really important.
Well, I was going to suggest that how do you, if you've got the Russians interfering from the north and helping the Taliban, if you antagonize the Pakistanis, which I'm sure Trump has already done. Afghanistan's a landlocked country. The supplies come through Pakistan and they fly over Pakistani territory. And then you've got Iran. If we had better relations with Iran, the Indians have built a road all the way from the Indian Ocean all the way up to Herat. That would be a perfect way to supply this landlocked country.
Of course. And the thing is about this that makes that so viable is that you simply do what we did in Pakistan. So first of all, we're not moving a lot of stuff through the Pakistani, what they call the ground lines of communication. We're mostly moving things through air, through Pakistani airspace. So it doesn't require a lot of logistical support, but we want to be there over the long term, and we want to be able to have options, and we want to be able to not be consistently screwed over by Pakistan. So what we could have done, if this administration were not so beholden to, there's no nicer way to put it, if we weren't so beholden to Israel's interests instead of our own, because that's what's really driving his opposition to Iran. I don't think he knows anything about Iran other than what the pro-Israel factions have told him. But what we could simply do is say to the Indians, we could contract to them, we want you to bring the following non-lethal goods through the port at Chabahar and into Afghanistan, and we don't care how you do it, whether you subcontract to Iranian companies or whether you subcontract to other Indian entities or something else altogether, like Turkish. But we should be using that relationship to diversify ourselves away from any sort of present or future dependence upon Pakistani GLOCs, which is the ground lines of communication. And we also have to say to Pakistan what it means if they shut off access to their airspace, because we're moving lethal goods into Afghanistan from Pakistani airspace. And we need to be very clear that we will tolerate no shut off to airspace. Otherwise, very harsh consequences will ensue.
Well, but do you think Trump actually alluded to that possibility when he talked about bringing India in to help in reconstruction of Pakistan? How else would India help?
What India has done, actually, India has done a lot of infrastructure development, or at least they've tried to. India, in terms of its aid projects, have actually had higher execution rates than many other countries because of the projects in which they've invested. But even India has had problems with its big flagship programs. For example, large Haidel projects in Herat. They've had some problems with finishing on time because of the predations of the Taliban. The Indians also provide a lot of budgetary support, and the Indians also do a lot of training of military personnel as well as bureaucrats. So what I would be talking about, which is Indian contractors working through Chabahar to get non-lethal goods into Afghanistan from the port, as well as the rail and road links that the Indians and the Iranians have built, would be a very different kind of thing. That would really be a private sector enterprise, as opposed to things that the Indian Ministry of External Affairs, which is their Ministry of Foreign Affairs, is doing in Afghanistan.
But to Trump's best buddies now, the Saudis want to go to war, and they want us to fight to the last American to get rid of the Iranian regime.
So, I mean, this is perhaps the most complicated and confusing array of alliances that I think the American government has had to confront in the Middle East for quite some time. So when we're looking at Afghanistan, the United States, Iran, and India have much more in common than it does with the things that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Pakistan want for Afghanistan. And the Afghans themselves are more in alignment with the United States, Iran, and India. Then you have the Israeli concerns over Iran in Syria, about Iran's involvement in Lebanon and its support to Hezbollah as well as Hamas. And then you have a different set of interests that are playing out in Syria. So in this new confirmation, Israel and Saudi Arabia are basically implicitly partnered together. And it's very difficult to tweeze out where the U.S. should go in terms of these alliance structures, because if we're looking at Afghanistan, our natural partner, quite frankly, would be Iran and India. because our interests are so similar. If we are looking at Syria, then our interests do not necessarily align with Iran. And obviously, if you're just narrowly focusing on the U.S.-Israeli relationship, then Iran is a big problem. So depending upon the problem set in question, the role of Iran is either adversarial or it's complementary, but the role is different. The role, either complementary or adversarial, is different in each problem set that we look at. And so what you're really trying to do is, you know, how do you work with Iran in the context of Afghanistan, but constrain its influence, its negative influence elsewhere? So, for example, its support to Hamas and Hezbollah. And then obviously there's the overarching question of its nuclear ambitions. So I think this is the most complicated mosaic of international interests that the U.S. has confronted, and unfortunately, perhaps the least talented presidential administration is being confronted with the most complicated mosaic of interests.
And my understanding is that they're likely to decertify Iran in 90 days or less than 90 days and pull out of the P5 plus one nuclear agreement and totally blow the whole thing up and make things so much worse with Iran. So that,
well, the Americans, so if they do that, what Trump is going to find is that he's going to be all alone, because this wasn't a bilateral deal, right? This involved many European countries as well. And just like his withdrawal from Paris, he cannot single-handedly bring this down. This isn't like the U.S.-Cuba rapprochement that he could single-handedly trash. And he will also find that there will be no international will to reimpose an international sanction regime upon Iran. In fact, the international community will hold him and the United States responsible, not Iran, and that's a fact. So I know that Tillerson and Mattis have different views than he does about the Iranian deal, and as with the Afghan policy, I do hope that saner minds prevail.
Well, Christine Fair, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure being on your show.
Well, thank you. And likewise, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And I've been speaking with Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program who specializes in South Asian security issues. She's a member of Women in International Security and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies. And her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking further into Trump's just-announced Afghanistan strategy that was long on bravado and promises, but short on specifics. چشمان مست سیاحت مبند نازنی نازداری با موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. He's the author of License to Kill, Hired Guns, and the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. And he has an article at Recoil magazine, No One Kills Terrorists as Fast as We Do. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young-Pelton.
Thanks, Ian.
And what do you make of the efforts on the part of Eric Prince, whose sister is the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, and the hedge fund billionaire Feinberg, who owns DynCorp? They both lobbied hard through Stephen Bannon to privatize the war in Afghanistan, and obviously a rather self-serving proposal since they'd be the beneficiaries. They said that they could, instead of the $48 billion a year it's costing us, they could have done it for 20% of that although nobody believes that. So they didn't even get a meeting. So the generals won, right, in terms of Trump's new strategy?
Yeah, you have to remember that Trump was open to new ideas because, they viewed Afghanistan as a 16-year-long conflict. In actual fact, it's a 38-year-long conflict ever since Carter approved the supplying weapons to the Mujahideen. But at the end of the day, if you actually look back and look at the relationship with each commander, each four-star that was running the show, they've always been short-circuited by some political decision or an election. So at the end of the day, when you sit down and you talk to very smart, capable people like General Nicholson, who's running the war right now, they can show you very clearly that it's about metrics. The more people you put into the field, the more you push back Taliban insurgents, and the more stability flows into the areas that we control or work with the Afghans to control. When we pulled our troops out, we mathematically reduced the amount of ticks or troops in combat, which then allowed the Taliban to flow into areas that we left. So it's not rocket science.
Right, but that's you're referring to Helmand, for example, as an example of what you're just saying. That's where 80% of the opium has grown. Now the Taliban control that. Do you think the fact that General Mattis, the Marine general, lost a lot of his troops there, is trying to, rewrite history, make the loss of their lives meaningful?
You have to remember that we had this weird dual purpose. One was to clear Al-Qaeda, not necessarily the Taliban. We overthrew the Taliban because they gave haven to Al-Qaeda. But we also added this sort of nation-building part. So when we went into Helmand, we actually had a member of government in a box, which was failed magnificently. So we tried to impose an artificial structure on the Afghans. And this has been our biggest mistake in Afghanistan, is going against the political structure and also fighting a war at the same time.
Right, but Karzai's brother ran. He was our guy there until he was murdered, and he was a thorough crook. So, do you think that the fact that General McMaster, when he was in Afghanistan, was in charge of rooting out corruption within the Afghan military, helpful?
But you nailed it there. Hamid Karzai and his brothers are not indigenous. They're not part of the political scene in Afghanistan. They ran a restaurant in Maryland, for Christ's sake. So, they injected Hamid Karzai as this mythical Pashtun, leader. In actual fact, we worked with the indigenous people. We worked with General Dostum. We worked with the Panjshiris. And we very quickly rolled up the Taliban. And it was when we created this artificial governance that we got into trouble. And of course, when we started spending billions of dollars, the Taliban began taxing those funds to support their networks.
So that goes back to Bush's neocons, the ones that brought us the great hero, the Nelson Mandela of Iraq, Ahmad Chalabi, who was all along working for the Iranians. So,
exactly.
So it's another one of their brilliant choices, right?
Right. So what I gathered from Trump's speech, which was not in depth, he was touching on the highlights, is we may now issue maps of Pakistan to our troops in Afghanistan. And you may find this humorous, but when I was consulting and advising the four stars, they had maps of Afghanistan, but not of Pakistan on their wall. And yet they slowly learned over, 60 to 90 days that this was where the support and the attacks were coming from. And second thing is there was constant battle between State Department and the military, as you saw with, you remember when McChrystal was fired, how demeaning he was towards the State Department's actions, in which he was fighting war against murderers, and they were essentially providing funding for projects that funded these murders. So there's always been a disconnect.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. He's the author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. And he has an article at Recoil magazine, No One Kills Terrorists as Fast as We Do. So when Donald Trump made some very peculiar remarks last night, it was very long on promises and short on details. He mentioned maybe they'll pay for it, the Afghanis will pay for it, suggesting somehow that we're going to tap into their mineral wealth, which the Chinese have already done, by the way. But he really did go after Pakistan, and clearly the Pakistanis, as you just pointed out, they've not only given safe haven, all the explosives come from there, the training, the logistics. It's hard not to come to the conclusion that every American who died or was maimed in Afghanistan, that blood is on the hands of the Pakistanis. But you can't start bombing Pakistan, surely.
Well, here's the dilemma. So the State Department has always secretly sort of coddled Pakistan because it's a nation of 200 million people that has nuclear weapons, and it is a fountainhead for Islamic terrorist training, you know, whether it's Kashmir or whether it's, you know, Host and people like bin Laden. And I have to say that we encouraged a lot of it in the 80s. And this is why I keep saying we've been fighting a war for 38 years, because we essentially created, or at least accelerated, this Islamic jihadist concept of bringing foreigners, training them up, and then sending them off to blow people up. So the State Department and the CIA have sort of coddled Pakistan because they don't want 200 million people to go insane, and of course the problems that would cause in India and Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a very poor country with 25 to 30 million people, and it doesn't really pose a threat to neighbors of the outside world. So once again, they've always just kept a lid on Afghanistan. What Trump is saying is we are now going to identify Pakistan as an enemy unless they do something legitimate or meaningful, which means, of course, getting rid of the Haqqanis, getting rid of the Taliban, which, you know, they make speeches from Pakistan. You know, we found bin Laden 15 miles from the ISI headquarters. I mean, it's not a big secret that they are essentially supporting and working with these terrorist groups.
Well, apparently one of the options that was on the table, along with the mercenary option of Stephen Bannon's at the behest of Eric Prince and DynCorp's Feinberg, was that the CIA take over. But apparently Trump CIA Director Pompeo didn't like that idea. So what do you know about that plan?
Well, so the argument is the CIA an intelligence gathering operation, or is it a assassination squad? And this has been a big dilemma. As you know, there's probably as many lawyers in the CIA as there are spies. The agency, after 2001, was feeling their oats because they essentially ran, or, you know, claimed to run, the initial success against the Taliban. So could the CIA work very quietly with sort of death squads or proxy units to wipe out the Taliban? Yeah, they could, but then they would subvert the whole democratic process in Afghanistan. And I think that's why the CIA pushed back. Now, to be fair to Prince, some of his ideas were very good. In other words, provide on-demand air support, increase the logistical flow of supplies to the Afghan military, increase the number of trainers. But once again, these don't have to be done by contractors. This can be done by the military with increased funding, or at least more focus on light, rapid operations.
So one of the things that Trump said about Pakistan, and I think by and large it's been welcome, and I'm pretty sure, as you point out, the State Department has been incredibly blind to the perfidious nature of the Pakistanis stabbing the Americans in the back at every turn. Obviously, there are concerns to stabilize a country of 220 million people, often referred to as not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And it's got the fastest growing nuclear arsenal on the planet, and there's an incredibly unstable place to begin with. But he actually said, use the word civilization as though they're not civilized. That's got to get under their skin, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, this is pure old-fashioned racism. If you go to Pakistan, what you'll realize is it's a very complex place. I mean, it has people who are actively fighting and dying against terrorist groups internally, and there are people who are funding and supporting madrasas that generate terrorists that go into Afghanistan and kill themselves. If you read Recoil magazine this month, which is on the stand, I go in-depth with the anti-terrorism group, and I detail where the terrorists were trained and the name of the ISI commander who trained them, where they were recruited. So I guess the thing that's really important to remember is that we should not demonize Pakistan as a nation or a people. We should demonize the strategy of using proxy forces to fight wars. And this started in Kashmir in the 40s, where they trained up, you know, fundamentalist groups to go die and fight against the Indian Army. And it expanded under our funding, under the Saudi funding, when we pumped in billions of dollars to fund, recruit, and train these people to go in and kill Afghan soldiers and Soviet soldiers.
But the point I wanted to make, Robert Young-Pelton, was that if you antagonize the Pakistanis, which I'm sure Trump has done, and in the case of the ISI and the military, it's well-deserved, but still, as you pointed out, this is a big country with a lot of nuclear weapons, and you can't ignore it. And the assumption is if the U.S. cuts bait with Pakistan, the Chinese will fill the vacuum. But if you antagonize the Pakistanis, which is what Trump has done, how do you continue this war in Afghanistan? Afghanistan's a landlocked country. Supplies have to come by air or through Pakistan.
Well, okay, so this is just my opinion, but I didn't like the secrecy of how this plan was developed. I didn't like some of the players that were being brought in to pitch ideas. We're in a very intelligent country in which a lot of people have a lot of experience in the region. And like I said, we've been there for 38 years, and we have plenty of institutional knowledge about how things can work and not work. I didn't like how the plan was developed essentially in secret and then presented to the American public as very vague. As you say, Afghanistan is a poor country. It's a landlocked country. We're not going to solve all the problems of that country anytime soon.
Well, but if as I understand a lot of stuff comes through by air, but it has to fly across Pakistan to get there, and they had these supply routes, all these truck convoys that kept getting blown up, and they come through the Khyber Pass, et cetera, and that's been the way, Pakistan's always had us by the cojones, if you like, because of the supply train. And so I can't see how you can antagonize them in that regard. The Russians was a supply chain at one point. It turns out that Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting that they had with the Russians, one of the people at that meeting was the guy that managed to stitch up the U.S. effort there at Manus Base and essentially get the U.S. kicked out of the northern supply routes from the former Soviet Union. And, of course, Putin is doing everything he can to screw with the Americans. So the Russians are now giving the Taliban sanctuary and supplies and weapons. So, and then Iran is another way. The Indians have built a road all the way from the Indian Ocean all the way up to Herat. That would be the perfect way to supply Afghanistan. But we have terrible relations with Iran, and they're likely to get worse under this president. So how much is that the real issue here is this landlocked country, and we just don't have any good options?
Well, I think what you just summed up was probably the best reason why these things should be discussed in public. You know, it's a geopolitical framework where you push on one end and something pops at the other end. This is Trump's first diplomatic foray. You remember, this is the very first time he's come up with a plan in which to handle things, and everything he said before this to antagonize the Russians, the Chinese, the Pakistanis, all comes back to haunt him, because why do people want Americans in a place where they're just going to cause problems? So, yeah, he's got a very big task against himself. So I just want to separate two things. One, the task of killing people is a very methodical sort of metric-driven process, and the military knows it well. But bringing peace and stability to a very poor country is a completely different topic. And this is the part that Trump has not addressed, and this is the part that you bring up very clearly, that this requires diplomacy, and of course he's gutted most of the diplomatic corps.
Well, they closed down the very office that Tillerson now needs if there is to be any diplomatic initiative.
Yeah, well, we're agreeing. We're not arguing.
Yeah. No.
This is the first step towards reality, and I'm sure his general sat him down and showed him how wars are fought. And he suddenly realized that, oh, I see, so diplomacy and war fighting go hand in hand, and economic benefit also fits in there. The Chinese have done a much better job of going in there, stealing the crown jewels, sitting on them, waiting for the country to settle down. Pakistan always keeps Afghanistan jumping because they want it to be a big spiky trap for India. And if we bring India in as a partner, which we should and we will, it'll just exacerbate Pakistan's anger towards being surrounded. So there's just a lot of questions that weren't answered, but at least he listened to sage advice regarding warfighting and the use of American troops.
Well, but you mentioned India, which Donald Trump mentioned in the speech of working more with India, particularly on reconstruction. That's the source of most of Pakistan's paranoia. Why they destabilize Afghanistan is because they don't want India in there on a two-front war. Isn't that so? We're just feeding into Pakistan's military's paranoia, aren't we?
Yeah, and of course. Remember, we also blocked the northern power brokers, you know, people like Atta Noor, who controls Mazar, and General Dostum, who controls the west corner. We PNG'd these people and antagonized them, and suddenly we realized that that's where the powerhouse is and that all the business between Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan and the north all flow through there. And we're left with this sort of dry, parched, southern, divisive area because of some 50s concept that, you know, Pashtuns must run Afghanistan and that we must somehow do something in the Helmand area, which is not the critical core of Afghanistan by any means.
So just in summary then, as we finish up here, Robert Young Pelton, long on promises, says we're going to just kill a bunch of people. You're saying we've been doing that. It's not got us anywhere. Somehow they keep finding more recruits, the Taliban. And then we talked about the need for diplomacy, even though the very office in the State Department was closed down by the Trump administration in their sort of purge. What's your prognosis then? One, on this vague plan, long on promises, short on details, what would you suggest is going to happen here?
Well, I would like to see people call for transparency in our foreign policy. I don't think secrecy benefits us. Secondly, I feel like Trump walked into a house that somebody else lived in and started tearing things off the wall, and now he's realizing why those things were there. And so all these things that Bannon encouraged him to tear down and throw away, he's now rummaging through the dumpster saying, oh, I guess we need that, I guess we need that, now I know why we had that. So he's learning on the job, which is frightening, but at least he's learning. And thirdly, the geopolitical importance of Afghanistan is really more tied to the legacy of the president rather than any impact on America. I mean, when we think about 9/11 and why we launched into Afghanistan, it was because we wanted to rid the safe places for al-Qaeda. Well, those safe places are in Pakistan. So at least after 16 years of not getting it right, we're slowly moving in the right direction.
Well, Robert Young Pelton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography is The Adventurist. And he has an article at Recoil Magazine, No One Kills Terrorists as Fast as We Do. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an assessment on the Let Them Eat Cake moment that has social media abuzz following an Instagram by Louise Linton, the trophy wife of the Secretary of Treasury.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't going to study war no more. Ain't going to study war no more. Ain't going to study war no more. Yes, war no more. Well, I ain't going to study war no more. Ain't going to study war no more. Gonna lay down my hymn book down by the riverside, down by the
baby, you're a rich man, baby, you're a rich man, baby, you're a rich man too.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robin Gavan, who is the Washington Post fashion critic, who writes about fashion as a business, as a cultural institution, and as pure pleasure. A 2006 Pulitzer winner for criticism, she's the author of The Battle of Versailles, The Night American Fashion Stumbled into the Spotlight and Made History. And her latest article at the Washington Post is Louise Linton Just Spelled Out Her Value System for You Common Folk. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robin Gavan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So is this picture that this Instagram that the wife of the Secretary of Treasury sent out as she was stepping down the stairs of a jet belonging to the United States government with United States of America on the side, a part of the White House fleet. And what she tweeted out, of course, along with this picture of herself looking fashionable with her husband behind her on the steps, mm-hmm. was great day trip to Kentucky, nicest people, beautiful countryside, Roland Murray pants, Tom Ford sunnies, Hermes scarf, Valentino rock stud heels, Valentino USA. And this is now turning into a kind of let them eat cake moment. So,
a bit of a kerfuffle, indeed.
So fill in the gaps between her showing off on the steps in her designer outfits and the response.
Well, I think if you just take the original post by itself, I mean, it doesn't really differ that much from the kind of posts that we see all over Instagram from, people who love fashion, who will often post photographs of themselves and let people know what they're wearing in their great enthusiasm for clothes and for style. I mean, what sets this apart, obviously, is the fact that she is the wife of the Treasury Secretary. She's getting off of a government plane. And when one of her followers commented critically about the post, in essentially a one-sentence critique, she unleashed a very condescending response that was really quite rooted in this idea that personal wealth somehow raises your value as a person.
Well, the person who replied or responded to her Instagram, Jenny Miller, mm-hmm. She said, "Glad we could pay for your little getaway. Hashtag deplorable." So I see why she got under her skin. But the response is definitely arrogant, to say the least.
Well, and I would also say that it reads as very much out of proportion to the offense. But, that's my, assessment of that. I mean, it clearly, as you said, got under her skin. But, to an observer, it seems out of proportion.
Well, your article at the Washington Post, Robin Gavan, starts out, "Louise Linton has proven herself to be an exceptionally obnoxious human being." So you're not pulling any punches there, right?
I am not. But, I think one of the things that was really sort of flabbergasting about her response was really that she shifted gears from the question of whether or not taxpayers had paid for her to accompany her husband on this business trip. And the Treasury Department said that, in fact, they were reimbursing the government for her, for her part of the flight. That it went from that, which she could easily have responded to a conversation or a one-sided or a monologue, really, that started to get into a lot of the things that make people uncomfortable about wealth, about the income gap, and just about whether or not their legislators, their people in Washington, have an understanding of what it means to be an average American.
Well, I mean, there's an added irony to my mind is that the trip, and I'm not sure what kind of business the Treasury Secretary was doing at Fort Knox, apart from visiting the gold, but that certainly smacks.
Apparently, he was pushing, he was advocating for tax reform.
I see, I see. But I'm sure she got a tour of the vaults there. And of course, gold is inescapably associated with Mnuchin's boss, Donald Trump. But I noticed in an interview that Jenny Miller, the woman who was dumped on by Louise Linton, the wife of the Secretary of Treasury, she was apparently on CNN, and mm-hmm. she said she found Linton's original post incredibly offensive. And just quoting Jenny Miller, she went to a state where one in five people live in poverty and many children don't know where the next meal is coming from. Instead of helping in some way, she chose to brag about her outlandishly expensive clothes. It's more than tone deaf. It's deplorable. I tend to agree with that, actually.
Well, I mean, I think you can, reasonable people could, you know, have a different opinion about whether or not there should be an expectation that, you know, about what she would be doing on a trip like that. I mean, it may, some people might be completely fine with her going simply to accompany her husband and lend some moral support. Others might expect that if she's going to go, she should, in fact, you know, engage in some kind of meaningful activity. And I don't necessarily think that, you know, displays of wealth are in and of themselves a negative, a bad thing. You know, people who have made a lot of money are completely within their right to spend that money how they see fit. I mean, I think where she really got into trouble was when she seemed to, in her response to Jenny Miller, elevate her financial status over others and to suggest that, you know, we should be measuring success and, in many ways, sort of, you know, national value based on how much money is in your bank account.
And again, I'm speaking with Robin Givhan, who is the Washington Post fashion critic, who writes about fashion as a business, as a cultural institution, as pure pleasure, a 2006 Pulitzer winner for criticism. She's also the author of The Battle of Versailles, The Night American Fashion Stumbled into the Spotlight and Made History. And her latest article at the Washington Post is Louise Linton Just Spelled Out Her Value System for You Common Folk. Now, the Scottish-born actress, Louise Linton, the wife of Secretary of Treasury, she had a big wedding at which the president and the vice president appeared as well. Mm-hmm. And she apparently she grew up, you know, in a castle. I don't know exactly what the family's wealth is, but apparently they used this castle in a somewhat cheesy movie that she made. But Mnuchin, of course, is in trouble from his classmates at Yale.
Right.
And he certainly seemed to have grown up with a certain amount of a silver spoon in his mouth. His grandfather co-founded a yacht club in the Hamptons. His father was a top Goldman Sachs trader and then became an art dealer. And at Yale, Mnuchin lived in the old Taft Hotel with Eddie Lambert, now billionaire investor, and Sam Shalaby, whose uncle Ahmed laid off Iraq infamy. And he drove a Porsche in college, and his classmate, Michael Danziger, the heir to the pharmaceutical fortune, also said recently, in response to the letter that was signed by all the classmates, you put a douche in fiduciary. Not exactly a compliment, right?
No, I mean, but I do think that, you know, that it's easy to, you know, just sort of automatically condemn, you know, the wealthy as selfish or self-absorbed. And, I mean, history has shown us that there have been incredibly wealthy people who have also been extraordinarily empathetic and have, you know, made tremendous contributions, to the cultural life of this country. I mean, I think about, someone like Brooke Astor, who was extraordinarily wealthy, but who also was highly philanthropic. I don't think that people necessarily recoil from wealth, but I do think that, at least in Louise Linton's case, there have been a series of instances in which she has sort of wielded wealth, as a kind of weapon, and she has used it as in a way that really sort of belittles those who are less fortunate. I mean, this is, the most recent case, but, in a quote that she offered up to the bridal salon that worked with her on her wedding gown, and sort of just saying, thank you so much, for making my special day wonderful. She sort of went into detail about how this bridal salon had flown in all of these wedding dresses that she could inspect and, look at for inspiration for something that she could have custom made. It wasn't so much a thank you for making a special day, emotionally meaningful. It was, look at the stuff that you helped me accumulate.
Well, I've covered the background of Steve Mnuchin, who was Donald Trump's finance director for his campaign. Of course, there's a local interest in not only is he local and went into film production, he also basically made his money out of essentially kicking people out of their homes with One West Bank here in Pasadena. And a lot of those people who became homeless as a result of that, of the means by which he became rich and used robo-signing, etc.
Right, the king of foreclosure and all of that.
Exactly. I mean, they've got to be feeling pretty burned up. But just in the Hollywood context, since I'm speaking to you from across the street from Universal Studios, I must say, I would suggest that Louise Linton is a classic trophy wife. That's the way she comes across to me.
Well, I think the only people who can answer that question would be Mr. Mnuchin and Ms. Linton, themselves, and they know what's going on in that relationship. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's interesting that both of these people, particularly her, a former an actress, someone who really understands optics, would not see how the potential for the degree of offensiveness that was here. And, maybe because, she thought that she was responding to someone who was not famous and didn't have a lot of followers on Instagram, that no one would really either see her response or make much of it, or that it wouldn't matter because she wasn't responding in this way to someone, who was a bold-faced name. But I do think it does offer people a window into her way of thinking.
Well, Robin Gavan, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your piece today. It certainly got my attention.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robin Gavan, who's the Washington Post fashion critic who writes about fashion as a business, as a cultural institution, and as pure pleasure. A 2006 Pulitzer Prize winner for criticism, she's the author of The Battle of Versailles, The Night American Fashion Stumbled into the Spotlight and Made History. And her latest article at the Washington Post is Louise Linton Just Spelled Out Her Value System for You Common Folk. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.